Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here every Thursday with you at 10 a.m. And I have an exciting show today planned for you. I have Saru Jayaraman as my guest today. She is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. And she also just came out this week with a new book called Behind the Kitchen Door. And that is going to get us onto some really good discussions later on in the show. But before I do that, I want to share with you, as always, some of these upcoming events that are coming up and tell you about my weekend this past weekend, which was just so event-filled. It was just really great. From my show last week in the morning, I was at Columbia Teachers College for a symposium on changing policy on the way we eat. And it was a great panel discussion with Scott Stringer and people from different areas of the food industry and policymakers, and talking about, you know, how we have to partner with people living in underserved areas and not go in with our own agenda to try to make change, to encourage healthier eating, to look at our school food programs, and you know, it was a celebration of a partnership between the Tisch Foundation and Columbia Teachers College. And it was really a great symposium. And then on Saturday, as many of you know, I was one of the guests in the audience at TEDx Manhattan, which was another incredible day filled with so many movers and shakers in the food world. And it was just inspiring to be in the audience and listen to Ann Cooper and Anne Marie Colbin and Anna Lappe, and on the list goes on and on. Steve Ritz was there. Of course, he was a presenter last year, but he was introducing someone this year. But, you know, just in the few minutes that he was up there sharing with us how his projects of growing kids and building green walls in the South Bronx, how that's just exploded, and all the things that he's doing. It was just a day filled with inspiration. And I think that's what TEDx is about, inspiring people and sharing ideas and trying to motivate all of us to stand behind what we believe and to work for it. And that's why I'm really excited about my guest today. I don't want to go into it until I actually get her on the air, but the path that her life has taken and what she is doing is just remarkable. Also, there are lots of events coming up, but the one that I want to share with you, which has already happened, but there will be more to come, is this past Sunday was the rally protest for the Keystone Pipeline, and there were over 80 environmental organizations that came together to create the largest environmental protest that this country has ever seen, and we all braved the freezing cold weather. This was a protest to protest the Keystone Pipeline. There were two buses that I helped to organize from Long Island that went down there, and there were over 150 buses from the Sierra Club alone, and the estimates were between 40 and 50,000 people, and it was really, really great, and we had a wonderful rally. Bill McKibben was there and spoke to us all about why this is the most important thing we all need to rally behind, because there are so many issues, as we all know about, food, fracking, environment, poverty, economy, medicine, healthcare. I mean, it could go on and on. But if we don't have a planet, all those other things will not be relevant. So we really need to save our planet for our children and our grandchildren and future generations. So this is really, really an important issue that we all need to get up and stand behind. And this summer, they are already starting to plan a protest that hopefully will be four times the size of this one. There's no reason we shouldn't have 200,000 people down in Washington. So keep your ears open for any action you can take. And do take action. You know, one of the things that Ann Cooper was talking about when she was up on stage at TEDx Manhattan this weekend, she just said, do one thing. And I recognize we can't all do everything, but do one thing. Everybody can get behind one issue and fight for it. And if everybody does that, we will get somewhere. But I think there's so many issues that, you know, a very common reaction is to just hide your head in the sand and not do anything. And we just can't support that anymore. We need to all help to make our world a better place. So some of the upcoming events I wanted to share with you. March 3rd to 5th is the International Restaurant and Food Service Show in New York, and that takes place at the Javits Center every year. And it's a fun place to go if you are into restaurants or food, or you want to just see the latest ingredients and supplies that are out there. It's a wonderful place to go. You know, I was able to find a lot of my environmental packaging there, you know, bamboo, boxes, and some really great things. So it's a fun place to go. March 6th, I am doing a workshop at the Waldorf School in Garden City. I'm returning to some of my roots. My kids went to that school, and I ran the cafeteria at that school for a few years. And they've asked me to come back and do a little cooking demonstration geared for younger parents and children, and trying to encourage parents to think of their time in the kitchen as family time. And there's so many activities you can do with your kids in the kitchen. And so when you get home after a long day of work and you need to put dinner on the table, rather than plopping your kids in front of the TV, bring your children into the kitchen and do it with them. And there's a lot of things they can do to help you. And it's also just a wonderful activity, especially in the winter when it's cold and we're inside. They can all help you make some really great soups. March 10th, Green Faith is having a seminar called Ground for Hope, Long Island. And that's going to be at Temple Beth David. And it's a coming together of faith communities from many different churches and synagogues to learn, to network, to plan, and to lead people in environmental issues and in understanding how we can take care of our planet. So that's just more of what I was talking about. That's going to be taking place on March 10th from 2 to 6:30 in the afternoon. And to find out about that, it's sponsored by Green Faith and the Long Island Council of Churches. So if you go to their website, you can find out more information about that. March 13th is the No Farms, No Food Rally in Albany, and that is sponsored by the American Farmland Trust. And I went last year. It's a really great day. You break up into small groups, and you go into the congressmen and senators' offices and talk to them about why it's important to support environmental issues, and a ban on fracking is right up there in the agenda. So that's really great because you really feel like you're doing more than it's more of a one-on-one. You go in with a group of six people actually into the senator's office, so it feels really good to do that. Then on March 14th, the Sustainable Institute at Molloy College has their monthly film series, and this month they're showing The Island President, which is about the island of Maldives, which is almost, you know, doing 100% organic gardening. And, you know, he's really taken up sustainability in a big way. And so the way they run their film series is it has always been free. Now they're asking for a $5 donation, but you come at 6 o'clock and they give you a delicious vegan dinner along with some popcorn, and then there's a movie and a discussion. So it's really great. So that's the Sustainability Institute at Molloy. And then, of course, we have the Just Food Conference coming up on March 29th and 30th at the Food and Finance High School. That was rescheduled from this week. So if you can make it and you want to go, do buy your tickets, because I remember from last year they sold out. So it's really important to do that. And I want to share with you my recipe that I made this week for my Valentine. It was a raw Valentine delight. And it was a cake that was a combination of a couple different raw desserts that I've made before, a chocolate ganache cake and a lemon raspberry cheesecake. And I kind of put them together and came up with this chocolatey, creamy, luscious, raspberry-covered dessert. So there's three different parts to it, actually four, I guess. There's the crust, the cheesecake filling, the ganache layer, and then the raspberry compote topping. So for the crust, you want to start with 1 cup plus 2 tablespoons ground raw almonds, 3/4 cup raw cocoa powder, 6 dates, 1/4 cup raw agave, 1/4 cup coconut oil, and a pinch of salt. And you're going to puree that in a food processor. You're going to pulse it so that it gets really, really fine and comes together as a crust. And you're going to wipe the bottom of a springform pan with some coconut oil. And then when all the ingredients are processed, you're going to press it down into the pan of the cheesecake springform pan. And press the crust down, and you want to work it up the sides so that you come up about 1.5 inches on the sides. And if you have enough, you can come up even a little bit more. After my cake was finished, just so you know, I was able to go around and trim the crust so that it was smooth all the way around. But when I'm putting the crust in, I use 2 hands, and I push the crust up the side of the cheesecake pan with 1 hand, and with the other hand I'm pushing down on the top of it so that I'm creating a smooth edge for the side of the crust as I'm preparing it. And then put that crust into the freezer and clean out the food processor and get ready to make the cheesecake filling. So for the cheesecake filling, you need 2 cups of cashews that you've soaked in water for about 3 hours, and then you're going to drain them. 2/3 cup of lemon juice. Fresh lemon juice is certainly preferred. 1/2 cup of raw agave. And if you're not a strict raw food person, you can use maple syrup. And I use maple syrup because I prefer that. But if you're a strict raw foodie, you need to use the raw agave. 1/2 cup coconut oil. 2 teaspoons of vanilla. And 2 tablespoons of water. And you're now going to process that in the food processor. You know, start with the cashews and really pulse it so that you get those smooth. Then add the lemon juice and pulse it some more, and then add the rest of the ingredients. And let it go for a while. Take a spatula and release anything that's stuck to the edges of the food processor and pulse it some more. And let it go for a while so that it really gets smooth and creamy. Then you're going to take the pie crust out of the freezer and pour this cheesecake filling into the crust and put it back into the freezer. Clean out your food processor and get ready to make the ganache layer. And so for that, you need 1.5 cups of raw cacao powder, 1.5 cups of maple syrup, again, agave if you don't use maple syrup, 1/2 cup coconut oil, and 1 teaspoon vanilla. And you're going to process that in the food processor. And let it just sit in the food processor for a little while till the cheesecake filling starts to set. So you want to wait about 1/2 hour before you put the ganache layer on top of the cheesecake layer so it doesn't mix together. And then you're going to put that on top of the cheesecake layer and spread it out with a spatula so it's even all the way around and put that into the freezer. Again, clean out your food processor. And I used a bag of frozen raspberries. And this is one of my favorite discoveries, was if you actually pulse the frozen raspberries, you actually get lots of little raspberry pellets instead of a puree. And I love that. I mean, you can go for the puree if you want and use fresh raspberries or let the frozen raspberries defrost first and puree them. But if you pulse them while they're frozen, you get lots of little raspberry bursts of flavor that looks like a crumble, and I like it like that. And so I use that, and I spread that on top of the chocolate ganache layer, and again put it into the food processor. And before serving it, I put some fresh raspberries on top. And it was just a delicious treat. And we're still working on it because you can only, it's so rich, you can only eat a little piece at a time. And so it lives in the freezer, and you can take it out 30 minutes before serving, and it's perfect because you want it to be really cold, not frozen hard, but still very, very cold. So that is my recipe for this week. Enjoy it. As you know, the recipe will be posted on the PRN website along with some photos and also on my website at iegreen.com. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest, Saru Jayaraman, and she is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center United. And she's now also the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. And how she got on this path is really amazing. I mean, Saru is a graduate of the Yale Law School and the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And she was profiled in New York Times Public Lives section in 2005 and was named one of Crain's 40 Under 40 in 2008. She's also 1010 Wins Newsmaker of the Year and one of New York Magazine's Influentials of New York City. Before this new book that just was released this week, Behind the Kitchen Door, Saru also co-edited the new Urban Immigrant Workforce. And this new book, Behind the Kitchen Door, is just a great, great work. And I want to let her tell you how she got into this, because the path that unfolds for each of us in our lives is always so interesting, the route it takes. It's very often not what we think it's going to be or what we planned. So, Saru, are you with me?
I'm here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I loved, you know, reading your story and how you got into this work. So I didn't really want to take that away from you, so I wanted you to tell us about how you got... What's that?
I said, sure, I can tell the story.
Yeah, yes. So tell us about the Restaurant Opportunities Center and how you got on this path.
Yeah. So, you know, 9/11 was really a pivotal moment for a lot of us, and it certainly was for me as well. Prior to 9/11, I had just graduated from law school. I was a labor organizer, actually organizing factory workers and custodial workers out on Long Island. And I would go home every evening to New York, to Manhattan, to Brooklyn, and enjoy the fabulous restaurants that New York City has to offer, and would enjoy those special moments that all of us celebrate in restaurants, you know, anniversaries, birthdays. I really feel like we as Americans tend to celebrate a lot of our culture in restaurants, more so than I think than other countries. And yet I couldn't remember from that time prior to 9/11 a single person who touched my food, who brought me my meal. Those people are generally invisible, and that is kind of the title of my book, Behind the Kitchen Door, because I feel like there are so many people in America, so many of us who enjoy eating out, who use restaurants as really the space of our most special and intimate moments, and yet don't know anything about what's happening behind the kitchen door, don't know anything about the workers who are touching our food, who are bringing it to our tables. And that changed for me on 9/11. On September 11th, there was a restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, Tower 1, called Windows on the World. On that morning, on 9/11, 73 workers died in the restaurant, and about 200 workers lost their jobs. And there was a tiny union that was inside that restaurant. They called me, it was HRE Local 100. They called me and asked if I could start an organization in the aftermath of the tragedy that would initially support all the workers who had lost their jobs and the families of the victims. And we did that, but we were pretty much overwhelmed shortly after the tragedy with calls for help from workers all over New York City and then all over the country. And we soon found out why. The restaurant industry right now is one of the largest and the fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. It's over 10 million workers nationwide. In fact, 1 in 10 Americans works in the restaurant industry right now. So it's a huge, huge industry.
Are you including fast food restaurants with that?
Yes, including fast food, yes. It's huge and growing. It also, unfortunately, happens to be the lowest-paying employer in America. So 7 of the 10 lowest-paying jobs in America, and the 2 absolute lowest-paying jobs, lower than farm worker jobs, lower than every other job in America, are actually restaurant jobs. Dishwashers and fast food preps and cooks are the 2 lowest-paying jobs in America. So essentially, you've got the largest and fastest-growing sector of the U.S. economy proliferating the lowest paying jobs in the entire country. And what does that mean? It means that workers in the restaurant industry, you know, who are basically at the bottom of the ladder, you know, live in poverty. To these 10 million workers, in vast majority live in extreme poverty because the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the United States is $2.13 an hour. And this is something I didn't know prior to 9/11, prior to founding the organization ROC, the Restaurant Opportunity Center. You know, as a consumer, I thought certainly that tips are a bonus on top of a worker's wage, that a worker is earning a wage and the tip is, you know, something that we would place on top of that wage, when in fact, due to the power of the National Restaurant Association, the tips are actually the core wages of these workers, so that in most states around the country, workers are earning in wages less than $3 an hour, and tips are supposed to make up the majority of the worker's wage.
Right, and you know, years ago when I used to be a waitress when I was in high school and college, I remember, you know, the tips also were under the table, basically. You didn't get taxed on them. And then somewhere along the line, I remember when that law changed, it affected me a lot. You know, you had to claim a certain amount of your tips. They assumed, you know, they added up how many checks you did, you know, how much money you generated, and they assumed that 15% of your tips, I mean, of your tally was what you made in tips. And so even if someone stiffed you and didn't tip you, you were taxed as if you got 15% tip on that.
That's exactly right. There's a story in my book, Behind the Kitchen Door, of a young woman who worked at an IHOP in Texas, Claudia. She worked for $2.13 an hour, but just as you're saying, the company reported that she was making actually $7.25. When in fact she wasn't. She worked many graveyard shifts where nobody came in or that was very slow, and tips did not make up the difference between $2.13 and $7.25. And there's one story that she recalled where she worked a whole night, you know, just on tips because, you know, the wage was $2.13. At the end of the night, a customer walked out, didn't pay the bill, and the restaurant actually forced her to pay for that customer walking out. She ended up owing all of her tips and then some. She ended up paying to work a full night.
That's very customary. Restaurants, if a customer walks out without paying, they hold the waiter or waitress responsible.
That's right. And so you've got, you know, millions of people living in poverty because of an industry lobby that refuses to pay its own workers' wages, that expects customers to pay its workers' wages for them. And that's not true of any other industry. It's because you've got this industry lobby, the National Restaurant Association, who was headed by the Herman Cain, former presidential candidate back in 1996. Herman Cain struck a deal with the Democrats in Congress saying, we, the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, that we will not oppose the overall minimum wage continuing to rise as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stays frozen forever. And so it has for the last 22 years. It's been stuck at $2.13 an hour. Now, there are states that have higher, like New York has a tipped minimum wage thanks to ROC, actually, thanks to my organization. We raised the minimum wage in New York State to $5. But most states around the country are still under $3. And so it means poverty, extreme poverty for thousands of millions of workers, literally. And the other key issue I do want to say, because I know your audience loves good food and cares about your health, Unfortunately, 90% of restaurant workers in America don't have paid sick days. And with wages as low as $2.13 an hour, they can't afford to take a day off when they're sick with the flu or H1N1. And there are stories in my book of workers working, workers who are great workers don't want to work when they're sick but have no choice for fear of losing their job. A worker who worked with H1N1, a worker who worked with conjunctivitis, pink eye. You know, many, many stories like this because, unfortunately, most workers in the industry have to choose between their health and their job. And so 2/3 of workers report cooking, preparing, and serving food while sick. And the Center for Disease Control says that 90% of foodborne illnesses can be traced back to sick restaurant workers.
Wow, so, that is huge percentage.
Yeah, I mean, I think these are things people just don't know, you know, what is happening behind the kitchen door, and just don't know that it's a lobby, it's a powerful corporate lobby that has, it's the same lobby that got pizza declared a vegetable in Congress, is the same lobby that actually has now prevented things like paid sick days from being passed. Companies like Darden, I will use as an example. Darden is the world's largest full-service restaurant company. They own Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grill Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse.
What are they called?
The whole company is Darden, but they own brands that all of us have heard of, like Olive Garden and Red Lobster. And they not only don't provide paid sick days to their workers, not only, you know, pay as little as $2.13, but they've literally poured millions of dollars into lobbying Congress to keep these things the way they are. And in the fall of 2011, just as they announced a partnership with Michelle Obama to provide healthy food for kids at the Olive Garden, a restaurant worker, a server in an Olive Garden in Fayetteville, North Carolina, was forced to work with hepatitis A because he didn't have paid sick days and ended up, you know, infecting people. 3,000 people had to get tested for hepatitis A and filed a consumer class action against the restaurant and won. So you really have to ask yourself, how healthy can the food be? How sustainable can it be? How good can it be for our bodies? You know, it may be locally grown produce, it may be organic, but if the people touching the food are sick or too poor to take care of themselves, our bodies are still going to suffer. Mm-hmm. And we all have to think about that if we care about good food, good quality dining experience, and good food.
Yeah, so true. You know, another thing that, that I was just thinking about is I know when I've traveled, you know, in other parts of the world, people don't tip the way we tip here. I mean, you know, here we really are accustomed to tipping because I guess somewhere we know that the waiters and waitresses depend on it. And in other countries, they don't. It really is on top of their salary. So a lot of countries don't tip, and because we have so much influx of people coming from other parts of the world to visit here and to live here, that must be impacting also on the tips that people are getting because, I mean, I know also because I've worked in a restaurant, I like to tip well. But,
that's right.
You know, I don't think that's the case with so many people.
Yeah, I that's so true. We do hear from workers that when people come from other countries, they expect the tip, you know, to be on top of a decent wage, and so they don't tip as well. But I guess I would argue that the solution in my mind, you know, it's not that we educate, we should educate people who come to visit about the system here, but more that we change our law to be more like theirs because restaurant workers in other countries have a decent, stable wage on which they can rely, and the tips are on top of that. And so, you know, the reason that they don't tip well is because they expect in their own countries for people to be paid well by their own employers, not by customers. And we should expect that of our industry as well. We should demand that our industry pay its own workers' wages. You know, the thing about tips is that even if you tip well, you know, even if you tip well, and I encourage everybody to tip well, of course, but even if you tip well, tips are fluctuate. You know, they're unstable. They fluctuate from day to day, evening to night, you know, season to season. And so workers just can't rely on that to pay their rent or to pay childcare for their children. And so that's why we need a base wage that actually could allow this kind of better security than tips. And let tips be on top of that, as it is in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
We do actually now have the opportunity to change it. President Obama mentioned in his State of the Union address that he is calling on Congress to raise the minimum wage. And actually, Congress is considering a proposal right now, the Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2012, to raise both the minimum wage and the tip minimum wage for all tipped workers in the U.S. And so we need people's support to join us in calling upon Congress to say we really need this for our own health as well as for the workers.
So raising of the minimum wage would also affect restaurant workers?
Absolutely, yes. Because of our efforts, you know, the last 20 years it has not. The last 20 years, every time the minimum wage has gone up, restaurant workers were not included. This time around, congressional leadership has included tipped restaurant workers in their proposal because we've been fighting for the last couple of years on the Hill to make that happen. And that's why we've written the book, really as a call to action, really to build a groundswell of support. You know, congressional leadership told us to overcome the voice and power of the National Restaurant Association and pass this bill, we're going to need to see a groundswell of support in America. And that's why we wrote the book. Danny Glover's movie company has created a series of films based on the book. And we're really using these tools to build a groundswell of public support to finally raise the wage for restaurant workers as well.
That's so, so great, because I know, you know, in President Obama's State of the Union, he also talked about how for anybody to work a 40-hour week and to still be living in poverty and to have to work two jobs, that you're working 16-hour days, and it leaves you no time to be with your family and be with your children and to
recharge your
vessel. I mean, you just can't, you know, people talk about, you know, putting out and putting out and putting out, and, you know, everybody knows that if you don't have time to recharge your battery, to give back to yourself, that you're not going to be able to keep putting out.
That's right. And not only that, but it results in people having to rely on the government. So food servers use food stamps at twice the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce. And what does that mean? It means that the people who put food on our tables can't afford to put food on their own tables. And that's just not fair. And it also means that the industry is basically externalizing the cost of paying its own people and forcing the taxpayer to feed its workers, right? Because these workers are relying on government aid, on food stamps to live, to survive, to feed their families. So it's an issue of really, yes, these workers' health and their well-being and their life, you know, living a life of dignity and being able to be with their children. And it's also an issue for all of us who pay taxes and care about our health and don't want to have to support people who are working full-time and shouldn't have to rely on government aid.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I'm wondering how also the universal health, well, we don't have universal health care, but the new health care plan, whether that can also help, because they also know, as you mentioned, because, you know, restaurant owners don't want to pay benefits and, you know, very often they rather have many part-timers than really full-timers, so that they don't have to put them on a salary and don't have to offer them sick days or benefits or health care or any of those things.
That's right. Yeah, actually, but this speaks to the power of consumer. All of us as people who eat out have incredible power to change this situation. So just a few months ago, when the Affordable Care Act was ruled constitutional, Olive Garden, Red Lobster, that company, announced that they were going to reduce all of their workers' hours to part-time, to evade having to provide health care for their workers through the new Affordable Care Act. And we were part of letting people know about this, and there was incredible consumer outrage. And the company actually announced that their S&P rating went down, their rating went down, because consumers were outraged over this announcement, and they changed their tune. They quote-unquote clarified their stance, and so they would not be reducing their workers' hours to part-time as a result. And to us, this is a perfect example of how much power consumers have, needs everybody who eats out to change things the way they are. So, 10 years ago, at least I certainly didn't see the kind of response to local and organic in restaurants the way that I see now. So, 10 years ago, restaurants, there just wasn't as much of a
trend about
restaurants.
It.
That's right. And so now, and it was completely, no pun intended, organic. Consumers asked when they ate out, is this locally sourced? Is this organic? And restaurants responded by providing locally sourced organic menu items. Now, it isn't always completely, true, but
right.
Certainly they're making the effort. Certainly restaurants are making the effort saying, we do this. If consumers ask the same kinds of questions about, I always encourage people to say at the end of their meal, I love the food, I love the service, I want to keep coming back, I want to let you know as a consumer, you paying the workers a decent wage, at least $5 an hour, and providing paid sick days are really important to me because those things impact my health. I'd love to see you do that. I mean, if every consumer said that at the end of their meal, wow, you would see dramatic difference.
Right.
Let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk more about what consumers can do, and how I can help to mobilize my listening audience, and how we can all work together to try to educate people about this. So let's take a couple minute break, everyone. Don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Saru Jeyaraman about her new book, Behind the Kitchen Door. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Sarah Jeyaraman, who is the author of the new book, Behind the Kitchen Door. And we're discussing how the labor practices in this country don't support healthy workers and fair wages. So, Saru, are you with me again?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Sure. So, before we took our break, we were just starting to really get into how people can make a difference. And, and of course, education is the first issue. So reading your book is a good start. But after that, what can people do to really try to support the restaurant workers, and help fight for fair wages?
Yes. Thank you so much for asking the question. So there are three key things that we believe can actually change the situation. So, I mentioned before the break that Congress is currently considering a proposal that President Obama mentioned in his State of the Union to raise the minimum wage for both tipped and non-tipped workers, for restaurant workers and all other workers in the U.S. It's been stuck at $2.13 for the last 22 years.
That's unbelievable.
And we as consumers can really build a groundswell to change this, and there are three ways we think that this can happen. First, so the book is, not just about buying the book and that helps ROC, the nonprofit organization, because the royalties go to the nonprofit, but much more importantly, we have kind of calculated that if we can sell 5,000 books in this week and this week when the book came out, we can actually make it to the New York Times bestseller list and raise these issues to the national stage. So it's
mm-hmm.
not just about a book. It really is about lifting these issues nationally. We're having some success around that. We were on CNN last week. We're actually this week number one on the bestsellers list for Powell's, which is the largest independent bookstore in the United States. So we're doing well, but we really need people's help to not just buy the book, but let everybody about the book and to buy the book this week. And
any connections
really
to Oprah?
if any listeners have any connections, great. But I feel like, I do think this is a very grassroots movement, and it could take just everybody on the phone, everybody who's listening, just getting the book and letting people know about the book. So that's number one. Help us build a groundswell by letting people know about the book and buying the book.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we've actually created a new eater organization called the Welcome Table, and it's at www.thewelcometable.net. And the tagline is Gathering for a Responsible Food System. And this is a new online to offline organization of eaters, of consumers. It's not very heavy, participation. There's no fee or anything. You just go to the website and join a collective space of consumers demanding change in our food system. You know, first around this issue of minimum wage, maybe later around paid sick days, maybe later around other food justice issues like transparency around GMOs or trans fats or other issues that people care about. We really feel like the Welcome Table can be a welcome space for all of the issues we care about in the broader food movement.
And honest labeling of fish as well.
I'm sure
you've heard all the, stories about, people telling you you're eating red snapper when you're eating something else or vice versa.
Actually, I mentioned Darden. The red lobster is known for horrible, horrible practices with regard to procurement of their lobster. There's definitely a lot that could be done to achieve a better food system in the United States, and we feel like the Welcome Table is a space to collectivize our voices and lift them up to Congress and show them there is a groundswell of people who eat, who care about these issues, that could actually have some political power. So the Welcome Table is a space. Now, on the Welcome Table, there is a National Diner's Guide. We put out the Rock National Diner's Guide, which you can find both at the website and on your smartphone as an app. If you go to your app store on your smartphone and you just put in Rock, R-O-C, National Diner's Guide, you'll be able to download the app for free, and it tells you how all the restaurants around you are faring on wages, paid sick days, promotion practices. And we created the app and the guide not to tell you where to eat, where not to eat. We want you to continue eating wherever you want to eat. It's more to give you tools to speak up at the end of your meal or even to tweet the message through the app if you don't feel comfortable speaking up. So we want you to use the guide so you know how people are doing, so at the end of your meal you could say, love the food, love the service. I love the fact provide paid sick days because there are some restaurants that received awards in our guide, or I'd love to see you provide better wages, paid sick days, these kinds of things. So that's what we're asking people to do at the end of your meal, or like I said, just to tweet the message through your smartphone app. So that's number two. And then the third thing we're asking of you really is this last piece that I just talked about. Please don't just tip better. Tip better for sure, but don't do that alone. Please speak up. Every time you eat out, just like people spoke up about local and organic, people ask those questions. We feel like dramatic change can be seen by people asking these questions every time they eat out. So please buy the book and let people know. Join the Welcome Table. Join our movement for change. It mean at most an email in your inbox once a month, but a way for you to collectivize our voices. And if you want more than just an email in your inbox, the Welcome Table is also organizing what we're calling eat-ups, which are gatherings of people who care about a responsible food system over food, where they can take action collectively on these issues over food. And then third, as I mentioned, to speak up every time you eat out. And through these methods, we really feel like all of us can raise our voices, let Congress know that the minimum wage needs to go up for tipped workers, that we need paid sick days. We think we can change these things in this way.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, in one of the articles I was reading on you, they talk about how we got the groundswell behind the local food movement through books and through movies and through education, and that this is really a whole new avenue of when you look at sustainability, people are not inclined in the past to really look at the food service aspect of sustainability. And if people cannot support themselves on the
wages they're making at the restaurant, well, then that's not sustainable. You know, just like I remember talking to the Long Island Farm Bureau's, you know, the Long Island Farm Bureau, who does not necessarily support organic farming. And, you know, this the head of the Farm Bureau, he was saying, you know, well, sustainability to us is a farmer not going out of business. And that's true, too. You know, and so, you know, trying to partner with the Farm Bureau and let them know we're on board with that, too. We don't want the farmer to go out of business either, but we want to help them transition to sustainable practices. You know, we don't want the restaurants to go out of business either, but, you know, these days, you know, you have celebrity chefs making millions and millions of dollars. They're not going out
of
business, you know?
That's right.
Go ahead.
Well, we have, you know, we've partnered with about 100 good employers around the country, restaurant owners that are trying to do the right thing, providing good wages and good working conditions. They range from celebrity chef Tom Colicchio, who's a star of Top Chef and is actually a really, really good employer, all the way down to small mom-and-pop restaurants that are, you know, really trying to do the right thing by their workers. And what we found, you know, studying these restaurants, partnering with them, is that they actually are doing better than most restaurants, not in spite of paying their workers well, but because they pay their workers well. They see less turnover, increased productivity, increased long-run profitability because their workers stay with them over the long haul. You know, that's common sense to most people. You pay your workers well, you treat them well, they're going to be more loyal, they're going to do better, they're going to serve you better.
They're going to represent your restaurant better.
That's right. So, you know, we have examples of how you can do it and not go out of business. We actually have created a round table of these restaurants to support one another so they can learn from one another about how to do better all the time. And I invite anybody who owns a restaurant to come to us for support or help. We provide technical assistance and training and all kinds of support for restaurants who are trying to do the right thing, and can also pair them up with other restaurants that are doing the right thing to mentor them if they want help. But all of these show that a different way of doing business is totally possible and totally profitable, and that we can all help move restaurants in this direction if only they could see beyond the very, very short-term profit, you know?
Yeah. You know, and it's not only the low-paying restaurant workers, but even, you know, there's this explosion now of cooking schools and people going to train to be chefs. And it's, you know, with all the food shows, being a chef has become this glorified thing. I'm a chef, you know, and I know from having worked in many restaurants as a chef that you are not paid well even as a chef. You're just a little bit above minimum wage unless you are the owner of the restaurant or you have, you know, you're at a big restaurant and you've worked there for years and you know, the main head chef or, you know, the primos, the sous chef. I mean, most restaurants do not pay even their chefs very well. You know, I look at all these kids coming out of culinary schools with huge debts, you know, $50,000 and up, you know, from going to school, and they're lucky if they can get a job, you know, that pays a decent salary.
Yes, and there's also a gender component to this as well. Only 1 in 5 chefs in America are women. And, you know, so you've got an industry, and actually 70% of the people who earn that lower minimum wage of $2.13 are women. And so you've got an industry in which all of the highest paying jobs are reserved for men, basically. And the industry gets away with basically legal discrimination, paying women less, paying women this lower tip minimum wage of $2.13. And because women aren't, you know, those highest paid celebrity chefs, for the most part, you know, only 1 in 5, you see this really dramatic wage gap between men and women in the industry. We studied it, and for women of color in particular, over a lifetime, they lose more than $600,000 because of the gender pay gap between men and women in this industry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, over how long a period? Over their lifetime, is that?
Over their lifetime, yeah. Yeah, women in general lose several hundred thousand dollars over their lifetime because of the gender pay gap. So it's, you know, for a lot of people, that's the ability to buy a home, that's the ability to, you know, pay for college for their children.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants their kids to do better than they did, and, you know, I will just tell you one more story from the book of a woman named Victoria who worked in Philadelphia restaurants for the last 22 years, worked on less than $3 an hour that entire time because the wage hasn't gone up, and now her children are in the industry, her daughter earning less than $3 an hour as well, and it's, you know, it's just, it's a long, long overdue for these women, for these parents, for these workers. We need to change this.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I had a catering company for 11 years. And, you know, as a chef, again, I always had to, you know, have my own business of some sort in order to make a decent salary. And so I had a catering business, and I remember my bartenders would be really upset because, especially when you're catering, you're pulling together an event. It's not like I had a restaurant where it was the same every day. So to pull off an event, it's teamwork, and everyone has to work together. And so my philosophy was I just paid everyone the same, whether you were a waiter, a bartender, or a dishwasher. And, you know, I think when I think back to those days and those parties, nobody worked harder than the dishwashers. I mean, or I should say everybody worked hard. But, you
yeah.
know, the dishwasher work was grueling. It wasn't, you know, walking around also mingling with the guests. And, you know, they were in the back in the heat and the, you know, scrubbing. And it was just so much work. And it was always just a really nice thing when at the end of the day everybody was there together and everybody knew that everybody was getting the same. And, you know, it just felt right.
Yeah, that's right. It's good that you value people, you know, that you don't see. And that's the point of the book, is to look behind the kitchen door and value the people that have been invisible to us for so long. Value the people who've been invisible to me. The book tells their stories in depth, you know, their lives, where they were born, how they grew up, how they struggled to the industry to make it. And then how they joined our movement for change. So it's not a long book. It's a book that's really the stories of these workers, and so it's an easy read. I really hope people will spread the word and let more people know to look behind the kitchen door.
Yeah. Well, everybody, the book is Behind the Kitchen Door. It just came out this week, right?
Yes. Actually, Valentine's Day, the highest grossing day in the restaurant industry. We released the
Perfect.
Book, and people can find it at, like I said, the website to go to is thewelcometable.net, where you can find the book, the short film that Danny Glover's movie company has created, and you can join our movement for change.
That's great. And if you don't remember that, you can just Google it, because I found it that way, too. Everyone, I've been talking with Jaru Jayaraman, who is a mover and shaker and has really been doing a lot of things. Who would have thought you would have been doing this, right? Graduating from Yale
Law School. Exactly.
And you just never know how your path is going to go when we start out.
Right.
You know, but if you stay open and follow your path, it will find you. So thank you for
thank
the work
you so
you're
much.
Doing, Saru. It's really just so great, and it's been wonderful having this conversation with you. Everybody out there, please support Behind the Kitchen Door. Tell everybody you know, and as Saru said, speak up when you go to those restaurants and make sure that the people serving you and behind the kitchen door are being paid well. God bless you, everybody. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll be with you again next week. Have a good one.